Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's editor. This month we're taking a different tack. Instead of presenting a single mid-length story, we've recorded three taut short shorts, which each, in its own way, packs a very powerful punch. The first is by John Harvey, an author Britain's Daily Telegraph calls one of Britain's most accomplished writers, and someone whose literary improvisation has caused the New York Times to compare him to a jazz artist. Here is John Harvey reading a story in his Jack Kiley Private Eye series, Ghosts, from the September-October 2009 EQMM.
It was mid-morning, and Kiley was in his office two floors above a charity shop in Tufnell Park, stranded between his second cup of coffee and his third. Investigations, read the ad in the local press. Private and confidential. All kinds of security work undertaken. Ex-Metropolitan Police. The absence of carpet made it easier to hear footsteps on the stairs. A pause and then a knock. She was late 30s, dressed 10 years younger, and looked all of 45. With the eyes of someone who woke up every day expecting to be disappointed and was rarely, if ever, disabused. Jack Kiley? Rita Barnes. Her hand was all cheap rings and bone. Kiley knew the name, and a moment later he knew why. Bradford Barnes, she said. He was my son. The flowers had spread across the pavement, close to the spot less than 100 metres away where he'd been killed. Tiny candles had burned through the night. Photographs and messages taped to the wall, always remembered. A tragic waste. Bradford had been on the way home from a party, not late, a little after 12, and had inadvertently brushed the shoulder of a young woman heading the other way. When he'd stopped to apologise, one of the men with her had raised his voice and then his fist. Punches flew, and then a knife. When the group sauntered off laughing, they left Bradford where he lay, a still warm statistic choking on his own blood. The 22nd young person to have been stabbed to death in the capital that year, and still months to go. Gang stuff, drug deals gone sour, the wrong look, the wrong word, the wrong place at the wrong time. Respect. I remember, Kiley said. The flowers had long since faded and been swept away, the photographs torn down. A year ago next week he was killed, Rita Barnes said. 3 days ahead of his birthday, and the police still ain't got a clue. She took an envelope from her bag and counted the notes out on his desk. There's 250, I'll get more. Find the bastard has did it, okay? What was he supposed to say? It was a waste of his time and her money. Well, he had the time. When she'd gone, he put in a call to a DI he knew at the local Nick. Jackie Ferris met him in the back room of the assembly house, its dark wood panelling and ornamented windows harking back to palmier days. Not got a clue, that's what she says. Still on duty, Ferris was drinking lemon and lime. She's wrong. We've had more than a clue since day one. Jason Means, it was his girlfriend Barnes bumped into. He's got form and a mouth to go with it, but forensics didn't give a shit, and surprise, surprise, no one's talking. Least, not to us. Ferris raised her glass. You might have more luck. Rachel Sams lived on the 7th floor of an 8th-floor block close to the closed-down swimming pool on Prince of Wales Road. 3 of the flats on her level were boarded up and padlocked fast. The first 2 occasions Kiley called, she refused to open the door, and then when she did, it was only to slam it in his face. It took a fierce squall of rain. Rachel hunched against the wind as she manoeuvred a buggy laden with supermarket carrier bags and containing a wailing 2-year-old, for Kiley to open negotiations. Here, let me help. Piss off. But she stood back, while after freeing the bags and handing them to her, he lifted the buggy and led the way. Kiley followed her into the flat and then, when she didn't complain, closed the door behind him. The interior was dominated by a widescreen plasma TV, the furniture, most of it, 3rd or 4th hand. Toys were scattered here and there across the floor. While Rachel changed the child's nappy, Kylie found a jar of instant coffee in the kitchen. They sat at either end of the sagging settee while the boy piled wooden bricks on top of one another, knocked them down with a loud whoop, and started again. "Darren, for Christ's sake!" "He's Jason Mean's boy," Kylie said. "What of it? Jason see him much? When he can be bothered?" "Bradford Barnes' mother came to see me a week or so back." "So?" "She wants to know what happened to her son." "She buried him, didn't she? What else she want to know?" "Who killed him?" "She wants to know who killed him. Wants some kind of, I don't know, justice, I suppose." "Yeah, well, she ain't going to find it here." Kylie held her gaze until she looked away. After that, he called round every week or so, sometimes bringing a small present for the boy. "Listen," Rachel said, "if you reckon this is going to get you into my knickers..." But stuck up there on the seventh floor, she didn't seem overburdened with friends. And now, as soon as he arrived, Darren scrambled up into his lap and happily pulled his hair. Kylie hadn't mentioned Bradford Barnes again. Not once. Then, 10 days short of Christmas, the sky a low, flat, unpromising grey, he got round to the flat to find Rachel hurling bits and pieces over the balcony, tears streaming down her face. "That bastard! That lousy bastard!" Kylie tried to calm her down, and she lashed out, drawing blood from his lip. When he finally got her back inside, she was still shaking, Darren cowering in the corner, afraid. "One of my mates rung and told me he's only getting married, innit? To that skanky whore from down Stockwell. Saw it in Facebook or something." Picking up a half-empty mug, she hurled it against the wall. "Well, he's going to learn he can't treat me like that, innit? He's going to pay." Kylie listened while she told him what had happened that night. How Jason Means had stabbed Bradford Barnes 3 times, once in the neck and twice in the chest, and then walked off laughing. He phoned Jackie Ferris and listened while Rachel told her story again, then promised to look after Darren while the two of them went to the station so Rachel could make a statement. 3 days later, Jason Means was arrested. Rita Barnes had tears in her eyes when she came to thank him and ask what more she owed him, and Kylie said to forget it was fine. He would have given the $2.50 back if it hadn't been for a little matter of paying the rent. "You're sure?" "Sure." She kissed him on the cheek. That night, Kylie walked past the spot where Bradford Barnes had been killed. If you looked closely, you could just make out the marks where the photos had been taped. A young man smiling out, his life ahead of him. Ghosts on the wall.
Our second short short is by current Edgar Allan Poe Short Story Award nominee, David Dean. The New Jersey-based author is also an EQMM Readers Award winner and a regular contributor to our magazine for more than 20 years. Here he is reading his story, Awake, from the July 2009 EQMM.
The old man settled back into the tangled welter of sheets and blankets that comprised his bed and sighed. From somewhere near his feet, his sigh was answered with a similar exhalation. In the moonlight that leaked around the edges of the drawn curtains, he could just make out the silhouette of 2 large pointed ears, beneath which 2 concerned eyes glistened and watched. Then, as if in agreement, man and dog grunted in unison and lay their heads down once more. For the old dog, sleep returned easily, and she was soon snoring. But for her master, a lifetime of loss, regret, and now loneliness, always awaited his return to consciousness and seized him fast in its talons. To counter this, he had developed a process by which he could soothe his mind of its anxieties and eventually return to sleep. This method consisted of a simple inventory of all the familiar and comforting sounds that his home and dog made within the overall silence of the greater night. It always began with his companion. Her deep, steady breathing told him all was well, and this provided the first step toward his greater relaxation. Keeping his own breathing regular while attempting to slow his heart rate at the same time, he allowed his mind to wander through his home of 40 years, seeking other familiar sounds that reassured him. First and foremost was the furnace. During the winter months, the reliability of its great warming breath held no equal as his ideal of comfort and safety from the elements. And now he looked forward to that series of sounds that heralded its arousal. The light tap, tap, tap of the contracting water pipe he had so recently used warned him of the dropping temperature, even as the winds outside scampered with tiny claws across the wall next to his bed. Then, as if on cue, he perceived the barely audible click of the thermostat, signaling from its perch on the wall that the moment for action had arrived. With pleasurable anticipation, the old man listened for the sounds that must follow. From within the greater darkness of the attached garage came the barely audible hiss of gas, followed by, after what seemed a long and dangerous time, the business-like snap of the igniter. Then, with a satisfying, distant roar, the flames were brought into being to warm his home. In his mind's eye, he could picture the dancing light playing across the stained concrete floor of the garage. And then, as the finale, the heater fan located beneath the staircase whirred into life as the warm air coming from the vent reached it to trigger its assistance in pushing the warmth up to the second floor. The house now hummed contentedly to itself as it dispelled the tendrils of cold that had seeped silently through the walls. The old man secured the blanket beneath his chin, even as his eyes began to dart and play beneath his eyelids. As sleep began to reclaim him at last, the voices of his wife, Claire, and their children called to him from somewhere not far away, though their actual figures were still withheld from him. In the dusty living room, the French clock he had bought her as a gift in Europe began to chime the hour in light, tinkling notes, and like a hypnotist, he counted each one as they sank him deeper and deeper into the welcoming darkness. The old man, now decades younger, watched as his lovely young wife toweled off his children next to the pool beneath a benign sun and a peerless sky, and smiled contentedly. The only sound that intruded was the reassuring crackle of expanding wood that signaled the triumph of the furnace over the nascent coal, the walls and door frames returning to their intended shapes and sizes. Claire noticed him watching and returned his smile. The kids were fussing about being called out of the water, and though he could not hear their words, their body language was unmistakable. A popping sound from somewhere to his left startled him, and he found himself vaguely troubled as to its source and meaning, but loath to turn away from his wife and children even for a second. Even so, Claire's face wavered in his vision like the surface of a pond disturbed with a pebble. When it settled again into the plump-cheeked, gray-eyed features that he was familiar with, her expression had changed to one of concern. The laughing smile having vanished like the sun he could no longer feel nor see above him. She approached him, still carrying a dripping towel. The kids leapt soundlessly into the pool behind her back. She spoke to him, and he strained to hear her words. "Did you remember to lock the front door?" she whispered, the words seeming to come from a great distance. He stared back at his wife in bereaved silence. Was this all she had to say to him, her husband of 50 years, after so long a separation? The mundanity of her words struck him to the heart, and a sob caught in his throat that snatched him back to awareness. As he opened his eyes, his young wife's words blew into tatters like an old cobweb, and he struggled to catch them before they vanished. But the sound that seemed to have prompted them returned to him with terrifying clarity, and he understood in that instant that it had come from one place, and that place alone. The seventh step of the stairwell outside his bedroom door. As the furnace switched off and its efforts faded into a long sigh, the house lapsed into the silence of a held breath. Then the dog began to growl.
Our final selection for this podcast is a story by Dave Rains, a writer who has been published in the horror and science fiction genres as well as in mystery. Here is Dell Magazine's editor Mark Legacy reading Suitcase in Slow Time by Dave Rains from the June 2009 EQMM.
He picked up the suitcase, and it exploded. And so Ben spent the moment before he died seeking justice. Time graciously slowed down for him. Once before, when he was 20, time had slowed. Runners on first and third, two runs down, bottom of the ninth, and Ben at the plate, a banjo-hitting infielder who spent most of his at-bats slapping singles to right. Ordinarily, he would count himself lucky even to foul off Alonzo Stein's fastball, but this time, as the pitcher's arm reached the top of his delivery, suddenly Ben could see clearly Stein's grip. Fingers across the seams, it would be a rising fastball. Dreamily, Ben amused himself by watching the pitcher's lips draw back from his teeth, ears pull back as his jaw clenched. The ball eased from Stein's hand, approached the plate cautiously. By the time it was halfway there, Ben saw that it would be high and over the plate, a dream pitch for a home run hitter, not for him. But when the time was right, Ben started his swing. He made minute adjustments, a little faster with the hands at one point, get the bat around, slip it upward a quarter inch, slight upswing. The ball hit the bat with a low rumble, and then the rumble rose in pitch and became a satisfying whack. The bat accelerated and twisted in his grip, stinging his hands. The pitcher's eyes widened in shock as time returned to normal. The ball leapt over the left field wall, and Ben went with his team to the College World Series. No time to dwell on the past. Low in his field of vision, Ben saw orange, the fireball ripping pieces from the side of the suitcase on its way out. Don't look, he thought. You'll dazzle your eyes. But obviously, he was not going to need eyes much longer. Take a last look. Baggage carousel like a miniature superdome. Passengers brushing shoulders and reaching in. A spiderweb of arms. Himself, walking stick in left hand. Suitcase in right. Explosion at his fingertips. His last magical moments. He needed some way to use this gift. The latch was twisting loose, pushed out by the expanding gases. The webbing between his thumb and first finger started to bulge toward him as the handle rose. The fireball was nearing his fingertips. Think! Think! Moments left. How would he use his last few milliseconds? Not watching his life flash before his eyes, certainly. I'd like to spend them with my family, he thought. A picture of his graying daughter developed in his mind, then pixelated away, to be replaced by his granddaughter, giving him the green and yellow Oregon strap, cinched now around his suitcase. Go, Ducks! He was sad and wished tears would flow, but his tear ducts were not yet aware of this disaster. He was melancholy, and he was angry, but in a curiously detached way. Adrenaline had not engaged, and probably never would. Angry. Hold on to that. I'm angry, he thought. I'm furious. Who dares rob me of my sunset years? As I approach the prime of my life, and I find I have the time of my life. Oh, shut up, old fool. Will you waste your time singing old songs to yourself? Or will you have justice? Justice, his mind whispered back. His was a life founded upon justice. Law school, clerking, prosecuting, judging, all in pursuit of justice. Give me justice now! Despair is a mental thing. He was going to be immolated. He would never know if his killer would be caught. Who? He thought, I have sent very few bombers to the pen. Who could it be? He turned his attention to his suitcase. Don't look down, he thought. But fuzzily, in his peripheral vision, he could see the suitcase. Black, pebbly plastic sides, now glowing red from the fireball. At his hand now. No, don't panic. Latches with his initials, as best he could make out. B.L. Even a green and yellow binding strap. But it was not his suitcase. He should be seeing the broad white scrape he'd given it just hours ago, throwing it on the curbside baggage cart in Denver. The scrape was not there. Someone switched suitcases. Instead of Ben's good slacks and sweater, there was a bomb inside. This was no general act of terrorism. The killer had matched Ben's suitcase and must have been after Ben, specifically. Horror is a mental thing. At the margins of his vision, he saw his fingernails bubble, fingertips blacken. Even in slow time, the pain would be mere instants away. Don't look. He also saw debris. He pondered this and thought, nails. Nails about the length of his finger. The heart of the fireball was pushing nails at him. Who, he thought. And he thought, justice. But wait. The killer was out to get him. Him, specifically. So, a bomb with a timer would not work. The killer would have no way of knowing when Ben would pick up the suitcase. And a bomb with a motion sensor would not work. The luggage would be tossed around like popcorn before it ever got to Ben. Come to that, weren't there inspections and bomb detectors in the luggage handling system? Therefore, the suitcase must have been switched here, and the trigger must be some kind of radio control, which meant the killer might well be in the building. Or even within line of sight, because the bomb went off exactly when Ben picked it up. The killer must have seen Ben pick it up. Just then, the nerves in his fingertips began to scream. One time in his life, he matched G. Gordon Liddy and held his hand over a flame to prove he was tough. This pain was like that pain, as an avalanche is like a snowfall. But he was still functional. Perhaps pain, too, was slowed down, gentled in some kind of macabre Doppler effect. It was bad, but not bad enough to stop him. Were those tears starting from his eyes? No, I have to see who has done this thing. His only chance was if the killer was in front of him. But, thought Ben, of course the killer is in front of me. He wants to see my face as the nails rip into it. Oh God, my hand! Little sparks were starting to flash in the corners of his eyes. Ben moved his attention to the upper left limit of his peripheral vision. Now, no people, just airport signs. Carousels 1 through 4. Arrow. An escalator. Families pushing smart carts. Shoulders jostling shoulders at the baggage carousel. And there, center right, a face, a hand holding a TV remote, or something, pointed at him with a clear line of sight. Do I know you? Who are you? What did I sentence you for? But he did not want to spend time remembering, putting a name to the face. He wanted to wreck this killer's plans. Was he the killer? The face was familiar. After blowing up Ben, the killer would toss the remote somewhere and blend into the crowd. Get away. There was no justice. A nail spun into the bottom of his view, like a gymnast on uneven bars, a very slow gymnast. He began to feel a brass pin from the handle of his suitcase as it plowed a furrow from knuckle to knuckle. I'm going to die, Ben thought. Despair is a mental thing, but so is hope. As he watched the spinning nail go past his vision, he remembered the pitcher and the diffident fastball. He commanded his eyes to shift toward his left hand, and his left hand to move his cane. Quickly, quickly, he urged, but of course, nothing moved quickly. So he plotted as he moved. Even before he could focus, he located first the cloud of debris, then his cane. Boundaries indistinct in his vision. The cane's head was bound in steel. Focus, focus, he urged his eyes. And faster, faster, his arm. Luckily, he had only fractions of an inch to move. The cloud of debris was approaching his left hand, and there were plenty of nails to pick from. His eyes focused. He picked out the right nail, but the cane was out of position. You have to move, he told it. Move just a fraction. The muscles responded, and the cane came around like a long-ago bat and slapped a single to right field. No, what was he thinking? Hard to think. There was a shard of plastic coming for his eye and fire on his arm. He slapped a nail between first and second. No. He slapped a nail to right center, right at the man with the remote. Nail him! Ha! Make him drop the remote. Make him leave a trail of blood. Would the police realize the connection? Do a DNA test? Fingerprint him? The nail's line of flight looked true. Of course, by the time it got there, Ben would be dead. But he had done what he could. Time mercifully sped up as the nails ripped his belly and the fire flashed his face, and his hand no longer hurt as he died.
All of the stories in this podcast are copyrighted by their authors. Music for the podcast is from a piece entitled Jazz Medley, obtained from the Community Audio section of the Internet Archive. Mixing was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.